Wednesday, October 2nd. Welcome on in Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, so glad to have you with us. Cherry.
Yes,
Cherry.
Avi.
Here's something that really burns me up.
Uh-oh.
When we do a show and we get an amazing comment from a listener and we don't fit it into the show,
yeah,
we run out of time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to make amends for yesterday's show because we got an awesome email from someone named Joni. If you missed yesterday's show.
Hi, Joni.
If you missed yesterday's show, you can download the Studio 2 podcast episode of it. It was all about nuclear power, and it was pegged to this recent announcement that they're going to reopen one of the reactors at Three Mile Island near Harrisburg. Here's Joni's email. Great email. My father was a mechanical engineer, and the project of his career was designing and building the nuclear power plant Three Mile Island. At the time, he had two teenage daughters that were protesting the plant. I was much younger, but there was a lot of screaming and fighting at the dinner table every night. I know that hurt him, but what really crushed his spirit was when the accident happened. He was devastated. I think he would be happy to hear it could possibly be in use again.
Wow, that's such a real family story connected to Three Mile Island. Wow. Great email, Joni.
Thank you, Joni. I think we're going to get similarly awesome emails today. The topic is very different. It's about that VP debate last night. What did you think out there? Who do you think won the debate? What stood out to you during the debate? And I'm really interested in that last one. What stood out to you?
Yes.
What stuck with you? Because now we've had a little distance from it. Okay? 888-477-9499 is the number to call. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
And we will have a couple of really smart people in studio with us to hopefully get the, you know, juices flowing in your brain.
Get the conversation rolling.
And I want to also say that I love our listeners. They have the best comments, the best calls. So I look forward to hearing what they have to say. 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Our trio of news stories, Avi.
Yes.
We're going to start with politics. According to analysis of data from the Philadelphia Inquirer, blue collar neighborhoods in Philadelphia are leaning Republican. Now, this analysis looks at 2020 election results, and it shows what is a very troubling trend for Democrats since working class voters for years have been very reliably blue.
The bedrock.
The bedrock, right? The backbone of the Democrats. But now it seems that Donald Trump has made the biggest gains in parts of Philadelphia where educational attainment is lowest and poverty rates are highest. And GOP strategists predict more of the same in the upcoming election here in 2024. In 2020, though, Biden made gains in parts of Philly where educational attainment is highest. So people with college degrees or more. And I'm seeing this sort of educational divide. And Democratic strategists say Harris must run up her numbers in Philadelphia if she wants to win Pennsylvania, a critical swing state.
This trend has been developing over the last 8 years. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It seems real. The question in my mind is, are we looking at a permanent realignment? And to be clear, we should let me put a little context.
Yeah, because Trump said changes everything.
You said leaning Republican. They're becoming more Republican. They're still heavily Democratic.
Let's just make sure we understand that.
Are we looking at a realignment that's starting to happen? Or are we looking at a phenomenon that is solely tied to Donald Trump and will basically reverse itself once he leaves? That's the open-ended question for me. I think we have enough data now to say it's real. Something has really happened, especially in heavily Latino
working class neighborhoods. Yeah.
But the question is whether it is a permanent realignment, whether we're going to realign even more in the future, or whether this is something that is it's just specific to Donald Trump.
And what also drew me to this story by the Inquirer was I talked to people, you know, I used to cover, you know, elections and stuff, a lot of the get out the vote efforts. And I talked to a couple of my contacts and they told me that they're doing the door knocking and that they have to have a lot of conversations and they're realizing that they need to build more relationships in some of these communities, these working class communities, that maybe those relationships aren't as strong as they used to be. So there's a lot of work to do. And so for that GOTV effort, they are having a lot of deep conversations. They're battling misinformation. So the data is real, and it seems to be backed up at least through the conversations that I've had so far.
Big picture, however,
yeah, is it's still Philly's still very blue.
And let me put some numbers on it. Hillary Clinton beat Trump in Philly by about 475,000 votes.
Yeah.
Biden beat Trump in Philly by about 471,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a little slippage, but it's not major. And if you look at the collar counties, the gains that Democrats have made there, add all those up, it dwarfs the little slippage they've seen in Philadelphia. So there's,
it's a turnout thing, though.
There's
you
a yin
get
and yang to everything. Just remember that.
It's a turnout thing, though. Yes.
Speaking of get out the vote, let's talk about get out the wins. For the Phillies in the playoffs.
Go Phils.
So the Phillies open the postseason at home. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Go Phils.
Yes. Thank you. One more time.
Go Phils.
Okay. The Phillies open the postseason October 5th. And to strengthen their home field advantage, they are banking on music.
Oh.
The power of music. Nice inky story about the people who craft the sound of Citizens Bank Park. And I did not realize this, but they've really upped the sound volume and quality and diversity over the last few years. They have an in-house DJ named Eddie Romani.
Okay.
His job, Cherry, is to melt faces.
Eddie M. Eddie R.
Eddie M. That's the melt faces part. Yes. Yeah. Eddie the melter. When there's breaks in the action, he gets people hype or he builds the suspense. They also bought on an organist in 2022 named Brian Anderson. And I've noticed this when I've gone to the park. This guy's great because he plays the organ, which people have been playing at ballparks for many, many years. But it's usually those traditional songs like do-do-do-do-do-do, charge. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But he plays a lot of pop songs, and people just get a kick out of it hearing those on the organ. So can I play a few clips?
Play some.
Is Brian the Maestro Anderson. Let's see if you can recognize this first tune, actually, Cherry. Let's play it. You know that?
I feel like I've heard this, but I'm bad with names of songs. But I know I've heard
this. Yeah, yeah. This is Hot to Go by Chapel Roan.
I love it.
Never heard it on an organ before.
It sounds so different.
Now, here's one that you gotta know if you live in Philly. You know that.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's the WHYY theme song.
Oh,
no.
Action News.
That's Action News.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine hearing
that. And I'm not even from Philly. I didn't grow up with it, but I still know it.
You want to hear one more?
Yeah, one more.
One more from Brian the Maestro Anderson, the organist at Citizens Bank Ballpark, the guy who was going to bring us a World Series. Oh, yeah. What you got your...
I got my little fist pumping.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to run on some steps. Let's go. Let's run up those stairs.
You're punching the meat in the factory floor.
And I'm running through South Philly with my fists in the air.
Yeah,
yes.
So there it is. We did like the story from the Inquirer about the people that craft the sound of Citizens Bank Ballpark. They're going to bring us some wins. They're going to overwhelm the opponent with their
musical talent. And make it a party in the stands.
I
love it.
One more story, Cherry.
Yeah, another fun fact about Philadelphia.
Yes.
Our reporter Peter Crimmins went to a new exhibit. It's called Lunchtime, the History of Science on the Food Tray at the Science Institute in Old City. Mm. You remember school lunches?
How could I forget?
Yeah, those. Chicken patty, baby. And that pizza that was like kind of cardboardy.
Yeah, sometimes they have French bread pizza.
Oh, that's special.
That was a special day.
Special Friday.
That was a special
day. Right,
Sloppy
there.
Joe's. We did Sloppy Joe's.
So I know how you love history.
Yes.
And, you know, being how we are always among the first, Philadelphia, alongside Boston, pioneered school lunches back in 1894, friends. They started it with the penny lunch program.
One penny, you get a whole lunch.
Yes, it was a penny lunch, and students paid for a penny lunch with a prepaid token worth 1 cent. And back in 1910, the Philadelphia School District adopted this program and expanded it to the city's public schools. School lunches, they were influenced by science and they changed over the years, and they were impacted by big events like the Great Depression, World War II. But
yes,
if you are so interested in this, you should check out Peter Crimmins' story. You can also go to the Science Institute here in Old City and check out the exhibit.
I got to shout out
one more thing about your school lunch.
Emma Smedley was the lunch czar for the School District of Philadelphia in the 1920s,
oh,
credited with formalizing the logistics of the modern school lunch program, the lunch czar.
Yes.
Emma Smedley.
And I just always remember the ladies with the little hairnet and the big spoon, and they're scooping.
Well, we're from Maryland.
Yeah.
At my school, the big thing was you could get Old Bay on your French fries. That was the most popular thing.
We didn't have Old Bay.
We had Old Bay on our French fries.
I've been cheated. I've been robbed.
Oh, and they were good. They were really good French fries.
I was cheating.
Shout out to Como Park Middle School.
Your own version of crab
fries. TPMS, the Blue Devils.
Who knew? So coming up, we're talking about last night's debate between vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz. Our question for you is, who performed better? The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back. This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Last night's vice presidential debate between Ohio Senator J.D. Vance and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz surprised many viewers for its civility. There was no name-calling, no snide remarks. The candidates looked at each other. When the other person was talking, they shook hands after and introduced their wives. Go figure. It felt like a throwback to the debates of old.
Cherry, some people even said it was a little boring
mm-hmm.
with all the congeniality and policy discussions, but we want to know what you thought about last night's debate, if the candidates accomplished what they needed to, and if any of this will sway undecided voters. Our big question this hour is twofold. Who do you think won the debate last night, and what stood out to you during the debate? So email us, studio2@whyy.org. or call 888-477-9499.
And we've got two guests with us in studio to weigh in. We have Farah Jimenez, Republican political commentator and Broad and Liberty board member. We also have Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Farah and Will, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
I would love to start with a caller. This is Karen from Montgomery County on line one, who has a comment about last night's debate. Karen, you're going to kick us off this hour on Studio 2. What was your takeaway?
My takeaway was, like you were saying earlier, the civility of the dialogue. I was struck by the gentlemanliness, the respect that was shown by both individuals in the discussion, and I was thinking that this is very important to the nation. This is how discussions of this debate should be held in a manner which is building to both people and building the nation's ability to do the same, to discuss differences in not only a civil way, but a respectful way, a degree to disagree.
Thank you so much, Karen. Thank you so much, Karen, from Montgomery County.
Yeah,
and if you had
point.
A little trouble hearing Karen's line, she was basically talking about the tone of the debate. That's what really struck her. And she was impressed by the civility of it, something we already mentioned. So I will let Farah and Will chime in. Was that your big takeaway, Farah, the tone of the debate? Did you have another big takeaway when you stepped back maybe an hour or two later? What was really sticking with you?
Well, absolutely the tone. And some people were said it was boring, and I think in part because they're used to the most recent debates having some key moments that were not nice.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was really wonderful to see an exchange a lot of times that they were saying to one another, I think we agree on this. The main takeaway for me with respect to the civility is the fact that we have an opportunity to take the temperature down. I think a lot of people are really concerned about the tenor in which this presidential campaign has taken, and also because when we look at the attempts on Donald Trump's life, there are arguments that we really do need to reflect on how do we have civil discourse and disagreements without calling someone all kinds of negative names that incentivize individuals to think our democracy is going to die if they have control over the White House. And so now I need to take them out. So I loved seeing that civility because you would finally have a policy discussion. And I love seeing that civility because it takes the temperature down for all of our electorate.
Yeah. Will Bunch, what do you think?
Yeah, I hate to be that guy, the contrarian, but I think sometimes we overrate civility a little bit. I think the tone of the debate doesn't matter as much as the substance. You know, kind of in line with what Farah said. I mean, I think, you know, after watching a series of debates with Donald Trump, you know, we're conditioned to outrageous statements and outrageous behavior on the debate stage. And, you know, it's true that nobody last night blurted out, you know, in Springfield, they're eating the dogs or anything, anything of that inflammatory nature. But I do think, you know, J.D. Vance in particular, I think his, you know, smart sounding, Yale educated, restrained patter, I think, you know, kind of covered up a lot of dishonesty in some of the things he was saying. You know, when I'll just give you one example. It was from early in the debate when they were asked about climate change, and he said, "We'll be fine on climate change because we're going to increase manufacturing and produce more energy." And he said it smoothly, and he just went on to the next point. And you know, anybody who knows anything about climate change knows what an absurd point that is. Yeah. You know, that those two things, unless he's talking about clean energy, and trust me, if it's a Republican, he's not talking about clean energy. Unless he meant clean energy, those things would increase climate change. And there were a number of things about that, about, you know, Trump's creating or not creating manufacturing jobs, about health care. There were a number of statements that sounded good and, you know.
It was a gloss is kind of
what you're saying. We're glossed right over. And yeah. I think that's really troubling. Just one other point I'd really make quick is, does civility kind of undercut the moment we're in, you know, because at the same time this debate was happening, the primary candidate for president on the Republican side, Donald Trump, is out there making statements like calling for this kind of national day of violence that sounds like the Purge movie, you know, and he's out there
talking about statements he made on the campaign trail shortly
before the debate. Right. Yep. At the same time as the debate, you know, he's calling immigrants animals and saying that they'll come into your kitchen and cut your throat and comments of that nature. And, you know, some of the best criticism I read this morning of the debate said, did it really meet this moment? You know, the urgency that in 2 or 3 months, the president of the United States could be somebody who's making these kind of comments and has these kind of beliefs. And you might not have even noticed that from watching the debate.
And I want to read a couple comments because Jason comments, he says, Vance was more polished, but Walz won the night. When the subject of January 6th came, that was Vance's massive fumble. But other folks have said, this is from Frederick, I think J.D. Vance was very presidential and made a strong case for the ticket. I believe he will help tone Trump down to a more normal level after they win the election. And so there's a lot of back and forth there. But one thing that stuck in my mind, did Walz, Minnesota, was he too Minnesota nice?
No, I don't think he was too Minnesota nice. I think that he looked nervous and anxious. He hasn't done a lot of interviews, neither has Kamala Harris. And so not really tested on the campaign trail, not forced to really reflect on the answers he needs to give, hasn't had a trial run on some of those answers, as we saw when he was asked the question about his China trips. He really fumbled. You could see him taking a lot of notes, which to me reflected some anxiety in terms of kind of setting up, like, how am I going to respond to these questions. I do think Vance is much more skilled. Obviously, he's a lawyer. He's a Yale-trained lawyer. And so he comes to this debate with a real capacity.
But Farah, given what Will just said, I mean, Governor Walz sort of miss the moment and not hammer Vance on some of the things that he a lot of the missteps and misinformation that he was talking about.
Well, I don't think there was a ton of misinformation that was from the Vance campaign, and I don't think there was a ton of misinformation from the Waltz campaign. I think they were both trying to deflect the very difficult questions that were being posed to them. I do think that Vance fumbled because when he was asked about January 6th, there wasn't a way for him to be probably as authentic as he would have liked to be in the response to that question.
Can we actually play that clip? Because we've been talking about it a couple times. And I just want to make sure if you missed this, this is the moment we're talking about last night. Toward the end of the debate, in response to a question about election results, Vance argued that censorship is the bigger threat to democracy than the January 6th insurrection. Let's play that.
This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship.
So that's what we're talking about, Farah, that moment. You thought that was Vance's low point of the night.
I think it was his only low point of the night, but it was an important low point. It was towards the end. And so for those who didn't stay all the way to the end, what they're going to get in terms of the debate depends on the clips that get shared. Mm-hmm. And so we shared this clip. We didn't share clips of the evasion of Waltz with respect to his own Minnesota abortion law and the fact that he signed an abortion law that removed the requirement for physicians, if a baby is born, to provide medical care. Instead, it changes the language. It dumbs down the language a bit to just provide care as opposed to have to make sure that the baby survives or is given all the attention necessary. So there was some evasion there. There's some evasion around some other questions, including the fact is if this is where you stand right now, I think the most incredible point that Vance made and so most impactful point is when he said day one was 1,400 days ago when Harris was elected and given the job of vice president and she could enact all the things that she's arguing for. But I'll add one other thing. One other thing is where I think Vance really had an opportunity to shine and really demonstrated his capabilities is when the moderators interjected themselves and violated the agreements from the CBS debate, which was that they weren't going to do live fact-checking. And when Margaret Brennan did the live fact-checking, he, I think, in a very authentic and sincere way said, no, I'm going to have a chance to explain what I am saying here because you're doing live fact-checking and you have violated the terms of this agreement. That really resonates, I think, not just with the general population, but deeply with Republican voters who feel very much that the legacy media and in these debates, the Republican is not debating one person. He's debating three. He's usually debating the two moderators and the opponent.
Can we play that clip as well? If people missed this, yeah.
Thank you, Governor. And just to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status, temporary protected status.
Well, Margaret, but
thank you.
Senator, we have so much to get to.
Margaret, I think it's important because
we're going to turn out of the economy. Thank you.
Margaret, the rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check. And since you're fact checking me, I think it's important to say what's actually going on. So there's an application called the CBP One app.
Okay, so that was that moment. Will Bunch, you had a comment on that.
Yeah, I really wanted to jump in on this because I have to disagree with Farah on this one. I think this was actually a terrible moment for J.D. Vance. And for a couple reasons. I mean, one is, again, this was another, you know, major untruth that he had woven into one of his answers when he's calling these Haitian migrants who were in Springfield, Ohio, when he's calling them illegal immigrants, when we all know that they're here under two different federal programs, that they have legal status. So to say that the CBS moderators should just let that lie hang out there and not call attention to it. You know, the fact that he had placed so much faith in this agreement that he supposedly had that there would not be fact checking to me, that just raises the question, why are Republicans so afraid of facts?
Don't misunderstand. Don't misunderstand. Yeah. The agreement is that there wouldn't be live fact checking because where Republicans get frustrated is that there is disproportionately, or I would say unilaterally, fact-checking of the Republican candidate. And this doesn't just happen on the presidential stage. This is an experience that Republicans who are running across the nation at whatever offices find themselves often set up. The amount of times that I, as a Republican commentator, get invited to be part of a diverse panel from a partisan perspective, and there are three Democrats and the one Republican, me, to stand up and voice Republican perspective is incredibly frustrating.
So you think that resonated with Republicans, but I guess the question is,
what do you do?
Did it resonate with the people that need to be persuaded? Because I do think, Farrah, some people saw that moment and said, here he is complaining about being fact-checked. They don't care what the rules are. They don't care about all the context you're talking about. They're saying this guy's upset because he got called out. But,
yeah, so Avi, I've heard you do a lot of interviews on the station, and I know you don't let it stand as an interviewer when somebody makes a point that's untrue. You want to correct a record otherwise it hangs out there. And in this case, you're talking about an event that was, you know, probably watched by 20, 30, 40 million people, and then that's a lot of people to have untruths just hanging out there without bringing them up.
So the question,
to Farrah's point, real quickly, give me a list of all the major lies that Kamala Harris said in the September debate or that Tim Walz said, and I don't 100% disagree, because I think there were one or two times like in the Harris Trump debate where they could have mentioned something that Harris said that was a little bit off, but there was nothing on the scale of migrants eating cats and dogs and some of the other things that Trump and then Vance to a lesser extent said last night. So, I've been covering what's going on in this country as a columnist for the last 6 or 7 years, and one of the unfortunate things is you've got one political party, the Republican Party, that bases a lot of its pitch to voters on untruths.
So, Will, I'm going to probably not reflect the nature of the debate yesterday, because I feel you're filibustering, and the question was directed to me from Avi with respect to what does it mean for the broader audience. And so the way that I think Vance responded is by saying, here are two Democrats who have abandoned their party and endorsed the Trump-Vance campaign. He noted Tulsi Gabbard, who, and of course RFK Jr. And both of them, if you watch the videos where they talk about the reasons that they're endorsing the Trump-Vance campaign, is for the very reasons that you're citing there shouldn't be a problem. This idea that you can't offer up countervailing points, that you're going to be thrown off the internet if you suggest that ivermectin is an appropriate response to COVID. We saw that all happen, the Russian disinformation.
Just connect the dots for me. You're saying that relates to the point about fact-checking in the debate?
No. Why people would respond. You asked the question, why would the larger electorate respond to the fact that Republicans are upset because Republicans get fact-checked more disproportionately than the other candidates?
It's the Republicans get shut down writ large.
Right, and so if you're somebody who is an RFK supporter, if you're someone who thought that Tulsi Gabbard did an amazing job when she campaigned,
The system is stacked against you type of person.
You also are hearing from them that the system is stacked against those who have opposing voices, and you disproportionately get shut down or you get questioned. It's not a level playing field for ideas.
And I want to bring in and just shift the conversation a little bit.
Bring
in another caller. We have David from Upper Darby, who has a point of view on both candidates from the debate. David, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, how are you? Well, I thought Vance was very evasive. He started by not answering the questions. I guess he sort of got into it, but he was more disciplined than I've ever heard him. So, he's not stupid about that. I thought Walz was definitely better on the issues, with the exception of the military service. And I wish they had asked a question about the 2020 election earlier. I'm afraid a lot of people didn't hear that.
Yeah, that was at the very end. Thank you so much, David, from Upper Derby. Can I read into just a couple more comments, Cherry, and then we'll move this thing along. So Lewis from Drexel Hill says, Tim Walz won the debate. He was speaking the truth. You could see it in his eyes. J.D. Vance lied. Emails from Jeff and Jenny echoing something that Farrah was talking about earlier. They really did appreciate the tone. They appreciated the civility, both of them. I'll just read Jeff's comment. It was refreshing to see two politicians respect each other, be civil, and agree to disagree in this current divisive political climate when one candidate for president is to blame, no names necessary.
Yeah, I want to play this clip, and I want to get both of your thoughts on this. This is the candidate sparring over Trump's handling of the Affordable Care Act during his term. Take a listen to this.
When Obamacare was crushing under the weight of its own regulatory burden and health care costs, Donald Trump could have destroyed the program. Instead, he worked in a bipartisan way to ensure that Americans had access to affordable care.
He ran on the first thing he was going to do on day one was to repeal Obamacare. On day one, he tried to sign an executive order to repeal the ACA. He signed on to a lawsuit to repeal the ACA, but lost at the Supreme Court. And he would have repealed the ACA had it not been for the courage of John McCain to save that bill.
And so I want to start with you, Will. How do you think Walz handled this? I mean, and this was a point that a lot of people said was a statement, a misstatement of fact on Vance's side. Your comments on that?
Yeah, well, I think in this case, and, you know, I haven't talked much about Walz's performance. Obviously, he was very nervous at the start. You know, he probably wouldn't have won the high school debate club.
No. Right.
But
Paul Kovach versus lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. But if you listen to his answer, I mean, he was well prepared for that answer because he brought four or five facts that really document step by step how Donald Trump tried to undo Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, Vance is, you know, and we all remember John McCain and the thumbs down and that dramatic vote. And, you know, he came within one vote of gutting Obamacare in a story. And even now, as a candidate, 8 years later, he's still saying that he would like to get rid of Obamacare, that he has concepts of a plan for something that would be better. When the truth is, we all know they haven't proposed anything. They don't have anything better. It's just I don't even understand what motivates it. But I think that was a very good moment for Tim Walz.
And how do you respond to that, Farrah? I mean, Trump did not want to keep Obamacare. And this was a total misstatement of fact by Vance.
Well, I didn't follow that at all because Trump absolutely did want to get rid of Obamacare. And there were a lot of Republican support for getting rid of Obamacare. And I think that probably is still the case. But for Pennsylvania voters and for national voters, it's an insignificant issue. Well, the thing that really rises to the top is jobs and the economy. It's immigration. It's democracy and for many reproductive rights. And so I think that may have been a shining moment for Walz, but it's almost irrelevant.
Interesting. Scott in Chestnut Hill says, social media and news outlets seem as divided as ever over who won last night's VP debate. But for me, it couldn't be clearer. An evasive, deceitful chameleon trying to make his unfit boss seem palatable, lost to a wiser teacher and politician who was able to reveal his opponent as a threat to democracy toward the end of the debate. That's Scott in Chestnut Hill. And I'm using that as a springboard because I'm sure you're going to disagree with a lot of that, Farrah. But J.D. Vance came into this with lower favorability ratings, if you believe the polls, compared to Walz. And there does seem to be something about him that people say, I just don't know if I know what that guy really thinks. And even when Walz kind of stumbles and bumbles a little bit, they relate to Walz. Do you think J.D. Vance did anything last night to try to at least even that playing field a little bit? Obviously not with Scott and Chestnut Hill, but a lot of people were praising his performance.
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. First is that criticism that you just expressed is one that I think many still hold for Kamala Harris. So, you know, the candidate from 2019 is not the candidate, at least in terms of the expression of issues that we're starting to see in 2024. And she still hasn't really been able to articulate why that shift. And so to the extent that there are people who are undecided, that is the big open question for the Harris campaign. So that criticism of Vance is equally, one could equally apply to Kamala Harris. House. With respect to how he handled that question, I think the reason that people walked away really impressed with him, even if they disagreed with him on the issues, is that the very opening question, he didn't dive in to answering the question. He gave his story. I am the child of a work. I grew up working class. I grew up the child of a mother who was drug addled. I was raised by my grandmother. I grew up in a rural community. So this is my origin story, and the perspectives that I have are informed by that experience. So you may see this polished Ivy League lawyer, but at my core, I am you. And as you can often see when you see Kamala Harris, and actually Governor Walz as well, they will often talk about the fact that they are middle class or grew up middle class. That's an attempt to humanize the person and the origin by which what informs the reason that they take these policy positions. I think he did that very effectively from the beginning and multiple times throughout.
We're coming up on a break here. Will Bunch, real quick thoughts on that. Did J.D. Vance sort of wash away some of that impression of him as an opportunist?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think if you were kind of half listening, or if you weren't, you know, a lot of voters aren't as engaged with issues as probably the four of us are, right? And yeah, I mean, a lot of it sounded good. I mean, you know, like a salesman, any kind of pitch, you know, if it's given smoothly, if the person comes off as sounding intelligent, it can be a good pitch. But I think, you know, I think some of the comments and calls that you've gotten show that people did watch it in a discriminating fashion and did see through some of the things that were in that polished pattern that were not true. So
yeah, and we'll have some more callers, we'll have some more comments on the other side of our break, but we want to hear from you. Who do you think won the vice presidential debate last night? What stood out to you during the debate? And again, vice presidential candidates debate last night. You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Studio 2. Welcome back. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are digging into last night's VP debate this hour, looking at the potential impact on this extremely tight race, or at least if you believe the polls, a very tight race. We have two guests with us in studio. Farrah Jimenez, Republican political commentator at Broad and Liberty, board member, and Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Folks, who do you think won the debate last night? What stood out to you during the debate? Email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499.
I want to bring in a caller. We have Betty from Huntington County, New Jersey, who has a comment on last night. Betty, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment here?
Well, the fact that Mr. Walz was well-versed on solutions, he had solutions for many of the upcoming problems that we face, and then he solved them, his state solved them on a state level that could be applicable on a federal level. And he knew what he was talking about, and he knew about solutions.
All interesting right. Comment from Betty. So,
Thank you so much. And you were listening. Yeah.
You apparently was listening on the radio, which, by the way, God bless Betty for listening on the
Thank
radio.
Thank you so much.
What Betty brings up that's interesting to me is the fact that Walz repeatedly talked about Minnesota. That did stand out to me, and it was a little bit about what I did as governor of Minnesota, or what I sort of helped get done in Minnesota, Minnesota as the model. I think there's advantages to that because it shows things can get done, but it also kind of takes the shine away from Harris.
Yes, yeah.
Farrah, what did you think?
Yeah, I did notice that. He did do a lot of, and I think because probably the last time he did a debate is when he was running for governor of Minnesota. And so that he's got
muscle
those,
memory.
Yeah,
there.
He's got muscle memory. Those are some of his natural talking points. But I think it underscored the big question, which again, Vance, I think was effective in challenging, which is if all those things are true, day one was 1,400 days ago. The things that you're arguing for that you believe will be the things you'll fix you have the ability, or at least Kamala Harris has the ability, to address those issues right now and is not doing so. So I think it served to kind of counter that and provide some fodder, I think, an opportunity for Vance.
And I got to ask you this, Will. I mean, Walz had the most to lose by doing this debate because J.D. Vance already had low favorability ratings and had the most to gain. Did he lose here or did he gain?
No. And, you know, I think that point that the caller made was a really astute one. In fact, I made the same observation in my review for the Inquirer about his performance, which is he was really strongest on domestic issues. And that's because, you know, governors are on the front lines of these issues. When you talk about, and these are things that really matter to people, when you talk about things like dealing with the drug abuse epidemic, for example. You know, he's on the front lines of that issue as governor of Minnesota. And, you know, that came through in some of his answers. You know, when you talk about not getting a second chance to make a first impression, I think it was unfortunate for him that the first question was about the Middle East because... Let's be honest. I mean, any of us would be kind of terrified to try and wade through the minefield of political and religious and other issues in that region, even no matter how well versed we are in the conflict. And, you know, like most governors, he hasn't been focused on foreign policy the last 6 years. And he doesn't have that kind of experience yet. He may get it someday. I thought he was smart. I thought he was smart. It was a good approach for him to play up his record as governor.
It's interesting. I was looking at some numbers from a CNN instant poll. This was not of CNN viewers, but it was a poll that CNN commissioned after the debate. Before the debate, they said Walz had a favorability rating of plus 14. After the debate, plus 37. Mm-hmm. Now, Vance made huge strides in this poll, too, negative 22 to negative 3. But I'm stuck in that plus 37 number, Farah. I mean, that's a massive favorability margin in today's political climate for Tim Walz. People do seem to just kind of like this guy for whatever reason. But I also wonder, does that trickle up the ticket at all? Or does the contrast between him and Harris somehow hurt Harris? I mean, what do you think about the way people view Walz in relation to his running mate?
So I don't know how to react to that because I don't know the poll. I've not seen the methodology of the poll, and I tend to be very skeptical of polls unless I understand.
But polls have shown him with positive favorability ratings, which
But I don't know about this big jump.
Sure. But on these tickets, look at the four people on the ticket, on the two tickets.
Yeah.
He's the only one who's consistently been positive. I'm just curious how that plays in this campaign moving forward, whether it's an asset or somehow a liability.
Oh, I don't think it's a liability, but it depends what you're buying into in terms of what this campaign is about. If you believe it's a vibe and joy campaign, which is what I think he's moving forward, then you're going to think this is terrific, that he's the vice presidential pick for the Democratic Party and that Kamala Harris is definitely running on a vibe campaign by some of the choices she's made around who she's conducting interviews with or how they run their campaign events. If you're focused on some really hardcore policy answers that you want, then you're going to have an open question because even if you don't like Vance, even if you don't like Trump, even if you love Kamala Harris, you might still wonder what changed between 2019 and 2024, or frankly, from last year to this year, and what made you change your opinion on fracking? What made you change your attitude on the border? What made you change your attitude on guns and gun access? Somebody has to explain that. And right now, to the extent that it's been noted that there's a chain, it's come from statements that are issued by her campaign. She has not shared her evolution of thinking. She's just changed, said, I now believe this. And so I think that's something that the Democrats are going to have to respond to for the remaining few people who are still out there uncertain about which way they're going to go.
Will Bunch, I'm curious about that idea of a vibes-based campaign and sort of how far you can get with that. Mm-hmm. What did you make of Farah's comments there?
Yeah,
that thought more generally.
No, I'm glad you asked that because I did want to respond to that specifically because I think the reason that Walz did so well in these post-debate polls, and I agree with you, so I'm mixed up with Farah. I think flash polling after debate has got to be one of the more inexact forms of polling. So, but as you pointed out, it's true that he's done very well in favorability, and I think he did do very well in the favorability department last night. And I think it wasn't vibes. I think I would define it as one word, and that word is empathy. I think he showed a lot of it. I think, you know, a key moment early on in the debate was when they did talk about immigration and they talked about the Springfield situation and some other things. And I thought that was maybe one of his best moments because, well, you know, he gave the position that, you know, Democrats have shown with their recent actions under the Biden administration that they don't support an open border policy or anything like that. But he also, you know, he also made the point that the Republicans are clearly not making, which is that, you know, that the refugees coming to this country deserve some compassion and some empathy. Mm-hmm. And he even quoted from the Book of Matthew, I believe.
Yep.
It was. He quoted from scripture.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's not something people normally expect from a Democratic candidate in a debate, but I think that type of I think that moment resonated with a lot of voters, and I think that's the reason he did so well in those
projecting
polls.
Empathy. Interesting.
Yes, I think so.
And I want to read a couple comments. Vicky comments: Vance, slick, smooth, wouldn't trust him with the nuclear football, a divisive senator, and obviously loyal to mob boss, not Americans. She says Walls, decent, compassionate, a successful governor, and loyal to Americans. I want to ask you, Farah, did J.D. Vance do enough to sort of shirk this idea that he's a weird guy, creepy guy, that Walls did such a great job of nailing that to him? Did he do enough last night to sort of to shake that off?
Well, that is a brand that comes from the Democrats. And I think that for a Vance supporter, they're going to reject all of those markers that come from the Democratic Party, because at the same time, Republicans are saying similar things about Waltz, you know, that he's bumbling. He looks like he's happy to just be going along on the ride with Kamala Harris. He doesn't really know where he is. He's
but that
out
was
of his
part
depth.
Of his job. Part of what he needed to do yesterday was to convince enough people that he would, if he had to, I mean, he has a top of the ticket, almost 80 years old, that he could be presidential day one. Did he do enough?
Are you asking if Walls did enough?
No, I'm asking you, did J.D. Vance do enough?
Oh, absolutely. I think he came off really quite presidential. And I think he was, I think, remarkably so, given the challenge in front of him, right? He's got to support not just himself as a future leader in the Republican Party, win over some people who were disappointed, I think, that Donald Trump chose J.D. Vance, or many Republicans who wanted him to choose somebody else who they thought might create some distance between kind of MAGA part two that J.D. Vance represents. But I think because of his ability to begin by telling his personal story, which resonates, there's just no way around it. And people know that story because they've also seen the film.
Or read the
and
book.
So like, they know and read the book. So,
by the way, Rocco agrees with you. It says, Walls lied about that trip to China. Vance was poised, had answers. He truly won that debate. We're getting ready to wrap up, but I did want to ask, though, about one exchange where I did feel like Vance did pretty well, which is Walls was talking about how experts – like the Harris economic plan over the Trump economic plan, looking at its projections on the deficit. And Vance said something to the effect of, but the experts were wrong about Donald Trump the first time. And Walls, I don't know, seemed like he kind of conceded a little bit there. What did you make of that exchange, Will Bunch? And this idea that sort of like people want rejection of expertise and the people in the ivory tower and all that kind of stuff. I mean, how do you feel about the way Walls and Vance navigated that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that really, in a way, may be the defining issue of this campaign. Yeah. You know, I mean, I wrote a whole book a couple of years ago about the college and non-college divide in American politics. And what that results in is you've got a Republican Party that is very distrustful of elites. If scientists are saying that there's climate change, they don't believe it. If public health experts are telling them you need to have this vaccine, they're very dubious.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, it would take a whole nother show to explain how we got to that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think when you say it was a good moment for Vance, if he's trying to shore up his Republican
strengthen that brand.
Yeah, that's their brand. Yeah.
Real quick, we are coming up on the end. Mm-hmm. Just let's cap it with the moment that you think will resonate from this debate most, Will Bunch and then Farah.
Yeah, I mentioned before, I think it was the whole fact-checking issue. And, you know, a lot of voters pointed out that, you know, that Vance then responded by trying to talk over the two women moderators right. to the point where they finally cut his mic off. And you know, there's been a whole issue about Vance's attitudes towards women. And
so you think that's the number one thing that will stand out?
I think a lot of voters are going to remember that moment.
Fair.
Yeah.
I think what voters are going to take away from this, or I hope they take away from this, is the Harris-Waltz campaign is asking voters to contrast styles. Mm. The Trump-Vance campaign is asking voters to contrast policies. And so if you are buying into the policies that the Trump-Vance campaign is moving forward, you're asking yourself, were things better under your economy better, were your jobs mm-hmm. better, were your prospects better, your ability to afford homes better under the Trump campaign, presidency?
We do have to leave it there. Thank you so much to the both of you. This was a fun conversation.
It was definitely a fun conversation. Thank you so much to Farah Jimenez, Republican political commentator and Broad and Liberty board member, and to Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We appreciate you both.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so we wanted to take a moment mm-hmm. because a little while ago, we took a bet on this show with Studio 2.
Oh my God, the
where
bet?
Where we put Avi to the test because Philadelphia was a category on Jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And we said if Avi got it, all the questions right,
sweep
didn't
the
miss
category.
One, yeah. then he would get free lunch. And I promised him that I would get him some swag that would be on the level
of
the king of trivia
right
that he is. And today, I'm paying up.
Oh, my, are you serious? Is it right here?
It's right here. It's been hidden the whole time.
Oh, my gosh.
So I got Avi a king trivia hat and a T-shirt
I love it.
To match. And we will have a picture of him rocking this.
Oh, my God. The trivia king.
Gee, you are the trivia king.
Wow, thank you so much.
There you go. In big old letters. I think
Tim
that is like 140
could not
font.
Win this last night. The trivia king T-shirt. Wow.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
You nailed it.
I did not know this was happening.
And that wraps up our show.
God.
It's produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Al Banks engineered today's show. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg. And I got to surprise Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Hey, I'm the trivia king. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk with you tomorrow.